Case for argument this morning is the Board of Regents versus Phoenix Software. Mr. Breitmeyer.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is John Breitmeyer. I represent the appellant, Phoenix Software International. The Court has called for has granted the petition for rehearing and limited it to two issues, or asked for supplemental briefing on two issues. Those being, first, whether Wisconsin has waived its sovereign immunity by its litigation conduct, and second, whether Phoenix's counterclaims are compulsory counterclaims. First, on the waiver issue, Phoenix obviously relies upon the line of Supreme Court cases that culminated with the Lapidus case, Lapidus v. Georgia in 2002, in which the court stated some broad principles. Although that court, or in that case, did only involve a removal of a case by a state from state court to federal court, and it involved the removal of state claims, we would say that the principles espoused by the court in that case are far broader than just limited to the facts of the case. Now, several other circuits have considered that issue, and many of them agree with that, particularly the Myers case from the Fifth Circuit. The only one that I think has disagreed with that and limited the Lapidus to its facts is the Stewart case out of the Fourth Circuit. And as Judge Wood noted in her dissent, that appears to be an outlier in the circuit jurisprudence since Lapidus. And we would urge this court to join in those circuits that hold that Lapidus should not be limited to its facts. There is a Seventh Circuit case that came out after Lapidus, but I don't think it can be fairly read to be limited to the facts before Lapidus. It just presented the same fact pattern. It's important.
You're referring to Omosegben, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right, which was simply saying what law should apply when state. When there's been a removal from state court to federal court and the claims presented are state claims.
That's correct, Your Honor. I don't think the court intended to say that Lapidus should be limited to that situation. It's just that was the situation in that case. I think it's important to note that Lapidus was a 9-0 decision. There were no concurring opinions. So, in other words, none of the justices formed the majority in other cases that found sovereign immunity, like the Florida prepaid case. None of those simply agreed in the judgment and concurred in the result and wrote a concurring opinion. It was 9-0 with all the justices agreeing.
So just to be clear, you're not arguing, I take it, that the mere fact that the Board of Regents participate in the trademark system constitutes any kind of waiver of sovereign immunity.
Well, Your Honor, we did not raise that at the trademark.
That would be inconsistent, I think, with the Florida prepaid and college savings cases, but it's the litigation conduct theory that you're looking at.
That's correct. Okay. That's correct. And one of the things I wanted to do, the Wisconsin brings up in their supplemental brief the Taylor versus U.S. Department of Labor case out of the First Circuit and says that compels a different result. But the facts in Taylor were different. In that case, a state employee brought a complaint with the Department of Labor alleging that the state or a state agency had violated a whistleblower statute. And the assistant secretary investigated that claim and found that there was some merit to it. The state agency then requested an administrative law judge review, a proceeding, an adjudicatory proceeding, and in that proceeding they asserted their sovereign immunity. And what the Taylor case said was the state could not assert sovereign immunity in the investigatory phase of the proceeding, and it did assert sovereign immunity at the first opportunity it got. I think that the state, you know, never asserted sovereign immunity at the TTAB, even if it could have. But the fact is that...
That's an interesting question. Do you think it could have done that at the TTAB?
Well, I think they could have, yes.
Under the FMC decision, perhaps.
Pardon me?
The FMC decision.
Right. I was going to say that South Carolina decision from the Supreme Court says that a state can assert sovereign immunity before agency proceedings. So I think that Taylor, if anything, hurts Wisconsin in this case.
Do you contend that Wisconsin waived immunity by not raising it at the TTAB?
Your Honor, we did not raise that at TTAB, and we didn't raise it in the district court. So we're not. I'm not purporting to raise it for the first time here. I'm just saying that I think that Wisconsin could have raised it at that point in time, and it makes their waiver later in district court even magnified more.
So you're really just using that fact to distinguish Taylor, not as
yes.
an independent ground of relief.
That's correct.
Yourself.
That's correct. So why is there a waiver? As this court acknowledged in its opinions, there's a two-prong way to appeal from a TTAB decision, that being going to district court or going to the federal circuit. And there's choices to be made there, and there's consequences to those choices. If one goes to the federal circuit, the federal circuit just reviews the TTAB decision on the administrative record. There's no new evidence. There's no opportunity for counterclaims. So Wisconsin had the opportunity to go to the federal circuit. I guess even backing up, as Judge Wood said in her dissent, Wisconsin could have done nothing. It could not have appealed at all and not have exposed itself to the counterclaims. But even if the court thinks that Wisconsin had a right to continue the TTAB proceedings, it could have gone to the federal circuit and avoided counterclaims.
Now, of course, Wisconsin says, had it gone to the federal circuit, you would have had the right under the statutes to object to that and take it over to the district court. If that had happened, what would the consequences for immunity be?
Well, in what Wisconsin says in its brief is that Phoenix could have forced it into district court, and I think that's the operative word. Phoenix could have, under the statute, forced the action to district court, but that's forcing it would not, I think they could argue, it doesn't result in waiver because
sure.
it's not a voluntary action by them to go to district court. It was Phoenix.
And there would be no waiver by litigation conduct. They have their sovereign immunity.
That's right. But they alone chose to go to district court. And, of course, one of the reasons to do that is you can put in more evidence. And there's a litigation advantage to Wisconsin.
Well, they, of course, lost at the TTAB.
Well, that's right. And they say in their brief, but Phoenix also can put in more evidence. But if Phoenix put in all of their evidence at the TTAB, then there is no litigation advantage to Phoenix to go into district court as far as putting in evidence. The advantage is to Wisconsin. And it really...
Well, structurally, the advantage is to the losing party before the TTAB.
Well, that's right.
Who might want, you know, another bite of the apple, essentially.
And that is where the unfairness comes in, because Wisconsin can take a free bite of the apple, if you will, a TTAB, if there's no consequences to it, to go later to district court and then put in more evidence. So
you're not prepared to say, are you, Mr. Breitmeyer, that Phoenix wouldn't have put in more evidence?
No, and I think Phoenix did end up putting in more evidence. But I think from a policy standpoint or a broad standpoint, it's more incumbent, obviously, on Wisconsin or the losing party to put in more evidence than Phoenix. So that's, I think, the major litigation advantage, and I think that's where the unfairness results.
What if the error at the agency level was something that could be reviewed without further evidence?
Well, I think...
They chose a district court route.
Well, again, I think that's a voluntary waiver because, as this court said in the CAE case, the district court route is not just an appeal. It's an appeal and a new action. And this court's precedents hold that, or at least those cases have, both the appeal and counterclaims asserted by the parties against each other for trademark infringement. So, again... If Wisconsin did not want to put in any more evidence, didn't feel it was necessary, they could have gone to the federal circuit and had their day in court, their appeal. And if Phoenix is the one that took it to district court, then they could assert that it's they're involuntarily there and there's no waiver. To paraphrase Justice Breyer in the Lapidus opinion, he basically said, it's unfair for a state to say, you know, I'm here, exercise jurisdiction over me to grant the relief I want against that party, but then in that same case, and on the other hand, say, but don't exercise jurisdiction over me. I'm not here. Don't exercise jurisdiction over me for the relief they want. And that's what Wisconsin's doing in this case.
All right, so maybe you could address the other question that we posed, which is if we assume that at least in theory Wisconsin has waived by litigation conduct its sovereign immunity, what is the scope of the waiver vis-a-vis these counterclaims? Does it apply to all counterclaims, permissive plus compulsory? Does it apply to anything that would fall within the court's supplemental jurisdiction? Does it apply only to 13A compulsory counterclaims? What authority do you have for your answer there?
Well, I think the best analysis out there is probably the Federal Circuit's analysis in the University of New Mexico versus Knight case. And in that case, they reviewed, and that case was decided after Lapidus, and the court applied the principles of Lapidus. And the issue was, well, if there is waiver, to what extent? They cited this court's opinion in In Re Friendship back in the 80s, I believe, where sovereign immunity was waived only to the extent of recoupment.
And they said, that's not quite what Friendship says. Friendship has this odd little ellipsis, and it says, waiver does not extend to what federal procedure terms permissive counterclaims, comma, claims for affirmative relief in excess of or different in kind from that sought by the plaintiff. So you could read that sentence two ways. You could read it as though permissive counterclaims was connected to that last bit with an or, you could read it as saying, well, you can even have a permissive counterclaim as long as it is limited to recoupment. So it's a little unclear, I think, what Friendship actually says.
Well, that's right, and I don't think it ever uses the word recoupment. But I think courts and commentators have looked at it, and I'm not saying this court has, but they've kind of looked at that.
A lot of other circuits have assumed, but putting Friendship to one side, explain why you regard this claim that you're making as a compulsory counterclaim.
Under Rule 13, a claim is compulsory if it arises out of the same transaction and occurrence. This court has elaborated on that or defined that to mean, first of all, this court has said that it should be liberally construed, and second of all, it said that we should look at whether there's a logical relationship between the claims. And in looking at the logical relationship, the court looks at, does it arise out of the same set of facts? And are the same set of facts going to be present for both claims? And if that's the case, then it makes sense to try those claims in one case. And so there's no question here that likelihood of confusion is the central factual basis of both the appeal of the TTAB claim and the counterclaim asserted by the Phoenix wants to assert for infringement and false designation of origin.
So would you say that if the factual basis of the infringement claim was different from the basis of the cancellation claim, so maybe cancellation is based on fraud before the agency and infringement is based on confusion, that there might not be a compulsory counterclaim? In other words, that it's fact-dependent?
Well,
I know that's not this case. At least as far as I know, nobody has accused anybody of fraud here.
Right. I think it would be a harder case, well, an easier case for Wisconsin to make that they didn't waive sovereign immunity. But I think the facts here are that these are compulsory counterclaims. So, because they do arise out of the same set of facts and they do involve the same evidence. I mean, one only has to look at Wisconsin's opening brief in this case when it talks about the appeal from the TTAB decision, Proposition 1. It's got three subheadings. A is standard of review. B is a review of the evidence in the record. And C is, was there likelihood of confusion between the marks? And that's going to be the issue on the counterclaim. Is there a likelihood of confusion? So I think this case doesn't even have to reach that issue because it's pretty clear, I think, that that these are compulsory counterclaims. So then the issue becomes, well, do we limit the waiver to a recoupment or a recoupment type theory, claims of the same kind as what the state asserts, or do we extend it to compulsory counterclaims? And there I think that the Federal Circuit's analysis in Knight, I think, should carry the day. I will say that Wisconsin raises a couple of other Federal Circuit cases, the Jett case and the Nassalot case, but those were claim preclusion cases. And I know that Nassalot discussed compulsory counterclaims and tried to say that it wasn't a compulsory counterclaim. Judge Newman of that court concurred separately to say, I agree with the result, that is, that the TTAB did correctly apply claim preclusion, but I don't agree with that we should have even considered compulsory counterclaims. It wasn't before the court. It wasn't briefed by the parties. I shouldn't say it wasn't before the court, because the court ruled on it, but it wasn't briefed by the parties, and the TTAB didn't address it.
Well,
so I think those cases are distinguishable.
The case where they really were stemming from separate packages of fact. I think there wasn't there a problem about a fraudulently acquired mark in Nassalot?
Well, where there may have been, but I think if we, well, I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Breitmeyer. Ms. Noel.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Kristen Graham Noel, appearing on behalf of the Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin System. With the Court's permission, I'll address the sovereign immunity question first, and whether UW, in continuing its defense of the cancellation proceeding before the TTAB, knowing and intentionally waived sovereign immunity with respect to counterclaims for trademark infringement on a different trademark.
And the trademark, if that's the issue, how can you look at Condor paren UW and Condor paren Phoenix and not think of them together? That's the whole problem here. Are they so similar that either cancellation is appropriate or infringement? I just don't see how you can just look at one of them by itself. Now, if there were a problem of fraudulent acquisition of a trademark, you certainly could look at one trademark, and it wouldn't really matter who had other trademarks, because you're not supposed to commit fraud on agencies. But I just don't see how your idea that they're so separate works, especially if this court's original decision finding that further proceedings were necessary on that confusion issue is to stand, unless you're really trying to reopen that as well.
We do believe that those are two different analyses, one for cancellation, likelihood of confusion, versus likelihood of confusion in the infringement context. And the Federal Circuit, which obviously hears a lot more of the appeals from the cancellation of TTAB decisions, has had that issue before it on multiple occasions. And we cited a couple of examples, the Jett case and the Mayor Brigmeier case. And
but you know, for that, it seems to me, I don't know whether we want to talk about sovereign immunity or whether we want to talk about the counterclaim as a compulsory counterclaim. But if you look at the history of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, and in particular the rules about joinder of claims and parties, the rules do not take a legal elements approach to either 13A or, for that matter, other rules that permit joinder of claims or parties. It's a pragmatic, fact-based approach. So even though I'm sure you're right that the elements of a claim for cancellation look different from the elements of a claim for infringement, when the underlying facts and events heavily overlap, that's when you see compulsory counterclaims.
Well,
forget about sovereign immunity, just in regular cases.
A couple of responses to your question. First of all, the state does believe in the context of waiver of sovereign immunity, the court should be very careful in how it applies. And issues of, for example, judicial economy should not outweigh the state's fundamental right to sovereign immunity.
But, you know, the cases that have said that have been cases where we have been asked to construe actually a statement or something for a waiver of sovereign immunity. Waiver by litigation conduct has not been under that strict construction rule.
I'm not sure I agree with the premise of that. Practically speaking, though, Judge, maybe I can address your question from a different angle. In light of the fact that this was a question of waiver of sovereign immunity, clearly that burden was incumbent upon Phoenix to prove a waiver. And
right.
Phoenix, and
I think we can all agree that either Wisconsin's choice in going to the district court as opposed to trying to overturn TTAB before the Federal Circuit, I mean, that's the issue. But I just want to follow up on my other point. It's the Second Circuit in the In Re Charter Oak Associates case that observed that the canon of construction saying that waivers of sovereign immunity should be narrowly construed as a tool that's used where the state gives an express waiver of immunity and that it does not apply to cases of waiver by litigation conduct. But anyway, putting that to one side, I understand that you don't see it that way.
And along those same lines, not to interrupt, but Phoenix did have the opportunity at the district court on a motion to dismiss, and not once but twice in briefing to this court, to point to those facts that are necessary for both claims, necessary, which I do believe is the standard for compulsory counterclaim. They pointed to likelihood of confusion at a 40,000-foot level. They never said, what does that mean in this context?
But that's why I get the feeling from your brief that you're really implicitly attacking the other part of this court's earlier opinion. Your brief kind of waves through that and says, our condor mark is different from their condor mark, and we've already decided that this is an issue that needs further exploration.
The state,
we understand that wasn't your position. But
right. The state obviously does disagree with the standard applied, we acknowledge that that wasn't before you in this re-argument or in the rebriefing. The Federal Circuit in addressing, and Phoenix has cited no cases, not a single case that holds that when you're talking about cancellation and infringement, that it's compulsory. And Phoenix's counsel brought up the fact that a distinction between NASILOC and JET and Mayor Berkshire, rather, is that JET and Mayor Berkshire, which were expressly limited to the likelihood of confusion analysis between cancellation and infringement, and did they provide claim preclusion. The Federal Circuit in NASILOC explained that they used the same test, that claim preclusion, they used the same transactional test that they use for Rule 13 compulsory counterclaim.
But this is the same court that decided Knight in the patent context, and it's also the case that our court in the CAE case saw the district court as a significantly different forum. Obviously, Wisconsin didn't want to rely on the record before the TTAB because you lost there. I'm sure that's why you thought that it was advantageous to go to the district court. And I note that your complaint in the district court actually asserted this court also has supplemental jurisdiction over any related state and common law claims pursuant to 28 U.S.C. Section 1367A. You didn't say only our claims. You didn't say anything. You more or less conceded that there's supplemental jurisdiction.
Actually, the state would disagree with that.
That is what you wrote, so you can't disagree with that.
But what was written in the complaint was not that the state waives sovereign immunity or that the state invites counterclaims.
You did acknowledge that the court has supplemental jurisdiction over any related state and common law claims pursuant to 1367.
And that would be a subject matter jurisdiction question when the sovereign immunity analysis is typically looked at in a personal jurisdiction analysis. Had the state actually done the Litigation Act and added more claims, that would have put this case in a very different light.
But it added more facts.
And as did Phoenix.
It doesn't matter. You're the ones who chose the district court. If Phoenix had chosen the district court by forcing you out of the federal circuit, then I think this would have been an open and shut case of immunity for the state, because you wouldn't have done anything to get there.
Well, the Supreme Court wasn't concerned with any advantage, and they've repeatedly stated that sovereign immunity recognizes that the state has an advantage. What they were concerned about in the Lapids case is unfair advantage. And it's hard to say.
I mean, there have been a number of cases in the telecommunications area in which the state has been brought into federal court on Telecoms Act theories, and the courts have regularly said there's no sovereign immunity because you have the choice, you the state, whichever state, doesn't matter, Illinois or somebody, had the choice of declining to participate in the litigation system and letting the Federal Communications Commission instead take that thing. So I think the lesson from those cases is when you have a choice, option A preserves your immunity, option B doesn't. If you take option B, you've waived by litigation conduct. You had a choice. You couldn't have been sued on a counterclaim in the federal circuit, right?
We would agree. We could not have been sued on counterclaims in the federal circuit.
You had a choice.
We had a choice, and the choice was to, consistent with cases such as Taylor, appeal to Article III court, but be careful and mindful not to conduct any litigation act that wasn't equally available to Phoenix.
I don't know why Phoenix's availability has anything to do with this. You chose to, as our CAE decision said, to both appeal and bring a new action.
Well, to be fair, CAE wasn't a sovereign immunity case, so I think it should be judiciously read in the context in which it was written. But there's a more fundamental point here that I want to make sure, and perhaps this addresses your question in a different way. The Supreme Court in the Alden cases and other cases has repeatedly recognized that the Constitution preserved the full extent of the state's fundamental rights to sovereign immunity. And the cases, including the cases that Phoenix most heavily relies upon, including an oral argument today, recognize that sovereign immunity has two parts. There's the federal forum immunity, which the Lapids case was directed to, but there's also a separate immunity for liability. So if you look at all of the cases interpreting Lapids, And they are in the removal context, which we don't believe this case is. But assuming it were in the removal context, the majority of the districts have, or courts of appeal, have recognized that by removing, even after Lapids, the state does not waive immunity from liability.
What those cases have said, I believe, is if, as was the case in Lapidus, there was a state law claim as to which the state would have had immunity in state court, the act of removal doesn't destroy that immunity. And I don't think anybody, that issue isn't really before us because the state claims have been dropped in this case. All we have is the federal claim. So if there would have been immunity in state court, you don't erase that immunity by going to federal court. But there wouldn't have been, if there wouldn't have been immunity, if there's been a waiver by litigation conduct by the state's own act of choosing a federal forum, then there's a waiver. States can waive.
Respectfully, we disagree, Judge Wood. For example, in the Lombardo decision, which was the Third Circuit decision, there were state and federal claims there. And the Third Circuit agreed that Lapidus isn't limited to its facts. Namely, you don't just look, it's not just limited to state claims, but the rationale should apply to state and federal claims. And at 198 of the opinion, the court wrote, while voluntary removal waives a state's immunity from suit in a federal forum, the removing state retains all defenses it would have had enjoyed in the matter had it been litigated in state court, including immunity from liability. It then remanded the case back to the district court with instructions to dismiss those claims based on sovereign immunity. Similarly, the Myers case, the Fifth Circuit case, cited in the briefs and brought up today in oral argument. While the court again concluded that Lapid should apply to state and federal claims, it expressly recognized that a sovereign enjoys two kinds of immunity that it may choose to waive or retain separately, immunity from suit and an immunity from liability. And in that case, it remanded to the district court in Texas for the district court to look at those federal claims and look at Texas state court and see, did Texas have immunity from those claims? And it's indisputable Wisconsin had immunity from liability on Lanham Act claims.
Right, but let me suggest this, though. When Wisconsin decided to submit what I will call the constitutional case or controversy to the federal district court, in the sense of United Mine Workers against Gibbs, in the sense of a transactional unit, Wisconsin was waiving its immunity from the federal district court's power to adjudicate that claim. I'm not talking about jurisdiction now. You gave that claim to the federal district court, and in giving that claim to the federal district court, you had to agree to abide by whatever the federal district court did with that claim. That's the whole point of the United Mine Workers against Gibbs concept, which I would say means that other things that fall within that same constitutional case or controversy were automatically within the court's power to decide. You didn't have to go there. You didn't have to give the authority to adjudicate that claim to the federal district court.
And by the same exact rationale, Texas, by taking the Myers case and removing it to federal court, under Your Honor's theory, should have waived immunity from liability of all of those claims that it brought up to the federal court, and it didn't. It brought them up to the federal court, and the federal court had to apply the immunity from liability from Texas, and that's why that case was remanded to determine whether under Texas law, each and every of these claims that were remanding, was there immunity from liability, and it's undisputed that there was immunity from liability according to Wisconsin's state law on Lanham Act claims. Unlike,
but I don't see how. Well, I just don't see how, because then I suppose Wisconsin can't get even the cancellation matter adjudicated by the federal district court when it has filed that lawsuit there, because it doesn't have to abide by the court's order. That's the logic of your position. The court could issue an order and Wisconsin can just ignore it because it has immunity from the authority of the court.
The state would disagree with
well,
that.
You're picking and choosing. You know, we'll abide by this order. We won't abide by that order. That's just intolerable.
Wisconsin has never stated that it would abide by this order or that order.
Well, you're
all
saying
the
that
claims
you're only going to abide by the orders that you've decided to let the court issue, not orders that the court issues in the case you gave to it on a different point.
It is not an issue of, when you're talking about immunity from liability, of the federal court's ability to issue an order, but rather the federal court, what authority it looks to determine whether there's an immunity from liability. The federal court would respect the immunity of the Wisconsin court.
Okay, so I think this is really just another way of phrasing the question whether Wisconsin waived whatever immunity it has through its litigation conduct, because sovereign immunity isn't like subject matter jurisdiction. It's waivable.
And Your Honor,
so that is still the fundamental question we have. Have you waived by litigation?
And the Supreme Court has repeatedly held, and the cases cited against Wisconsin, namely Myers and Lombardo, all recognize that you can waive separately immunity from a federal forum, whether this federal court can decide these issues, versus immunity from a liability, which presumably the federal court would apply to those other claims.
Right, but I mean, I would say that most of the circuits are against you here, and I don't think that, I mean, again, you can state that principle, as you put it a minute ago, at the 40,000-foot level, but then when you move down to this, the courts of appeals that have recognized that Lapidus applies to our kinds of situation include the Third Circuit, the Fifth, the Ninth, the Tenth, you know, not the Fourth, of course, you know, we have a split. And the courts that have recognized compulsory counterclaims are legion, pretty much everybody.
Your Honor, I forgive me if I'm repeating myself. I believe if you read the Third Circuit's opinion and the Fifth Circuit's opinion, they very clearly respect the state's right to immunity from liability as opposed to forum. So if you apply those cases to the case at hand, they would respect immunity, Wisconsin's immunity from liability.
But
so
there's no remand. Wisconsin didn't find it, didn't move the case to federal court. I mean, Wisconsin filed this case in the federal court and is trying to tell the federal court which part of the case or controversy it can adjudicate, despite the fact that Wisconsin acknowledged, you know, that the whole case was there. I mean, so I don't know. I find the situation very contradictory.
Ms. Noel, would be your view of the difference between litigation advantage and unfair litigation advantage? What do you think the court, high court, has in mind when it speaks of
unfair? Well, the Lapids is a good example of an unfair litigation advantage. In that case, Georgia had waived immunity from liability already. It then removed the case where it could have been subject to liability in state court. It removes the case up to federal court and then claims forum liability. And so it effectively is trying to reclaim an immunity that it had already waived.
So what's the lack of unfairness in your case?
All Wisconsin did was continue the defense of the – it continued the TTAB effectively proceeding. It continued its defense. It did not assert any counterclaim. It did not seek declaratory relief. It did not seek to invalidate Phoenix's trademark. Rather, it kept the issues very narrowly tailored to the defense, its appeal of the cancellation of its own trademark. All of the advantages that Wisconsin took advantage of were equally available to Phoenix to use.
Was the trademark canceled or the registration canceled?
You corrected me. It was just the registration. So there is a big difference between registration on the one hand and trademark law generally. So even if, for example, if the cancellation of the registration stands, Wisconsin could still have other rights under Lanham Act to continue to use the Condor mark. It's the registration itself that it would no longer be able to use. That's one example of how Phoenix's relief that it seeks is of a different kind or nature. It extends beyond defeating UW's claim, because UW is just trying to preserve its registration.
Which is just to say why it's a counterclaim instead of a defense. I mean, obviously, if it's just a defense, you assert it as a defense to whatever claim it is. Counterclaims, by definition, seek relief that goes beyond that which you could acquire as a defense.
But the case is looking
to find a counterclaim.
Looking at certainly recoupment or how the Federal Circuit.
Well, recoupment, you would agree, recoupment makes no sense in this situation because Wisconsin isn't asking for any money from Phoenix, and therefore there's nothing to recoup against. Recoupment means nothing, actually, here.
We would disagree, because what Phoenix is effectively asking for is nullifying Wisconsin's what used to be thought of as common law trademark rights, up and beyond just whether it has the right to a registration. And as the Federal Circuit...
Recoupment is a money term. I mean, there's no... Recoupment makes no sense here.
Okay. Even if one were to apply the outside the sovereign immunity context, the Rule 13 compulsory counterclaim analysis, the only cases that have been cited to this court that we have looking specifically to infringement on the one hand and cancellation on the other have uniformly held that the transactional facts involved in both those situations render it not a compulsory counterclaim or not having preclusive effect. There is potentially, as the treatises have remarked, you might have an issue of issue preclusion, but Phoenix has cited no cases that support that. UW hasn't seen cases that would support that. But that doesn't arise to the level of claim preclusion, which is the equivalent same transactional test as one would apply in Rule 13.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Hello, Mr. Breitmeyer.
In the University of New Mexico versus Knight case out of the Federal Circuit, the university in that case saw the error of its ways. It originally filed the case and sought money damages, as well as just a declaration that it had rights to these patents. But it saw the error of its ways, and it tried to amend the complaint to delete any claim for money damages for the very reason that is mentioned here, thinking that sovereign immunity, even if it's waived, would not be waived as to liability. The Knight Court first addressed whether the amendment should have been granted, and it said it should have. So money damages was out. The university was not asking for money damages. But then the Knight Court went on to address whether the defendants could assert a claim for money damages, the liability, because the sovereign immunity had been waived. And that's when the court gets into the discussion of recoupment versus compulsory counterclaims. And it cites Lapidus and quotes from the opinion, the part that says that a constitution that would allow the state to, on the one hand, say, assert jurisdiction over me and grant me relief, but don't assert jurisdiction over me to give them relief, would be unfair, would be anomalous, and they say in a constitution that permitted states to follow their litigation interests by freely asserting both claims in the same case could generate seriously unfair results. And that's what we have here. They didn't purport to limit it, the Supreme Court or the Knight Court, to claims for liability. The 11th Amendment certainly doesn't address that. And so I don't think it's a fair distinction to say, well, now we're going to piecemeal this, and now we're going to look at whether they waived it for liability or money damages. If they waived it, they waived it. And I do think that these are compulsory counterclaims. I think if the court followed any of the other circuits on that issue, the Knight Court, coming in the wake of Lapidus and applying the principles from Lapidus, would be the way to go as far as a rule governing the extent of the sovereign waiver of the sovereign immunity. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Breitmeyer. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. And the